Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 242, recorded March 9th, 2015.
242.
That's almost the answer to the universe.
Pretty auspicious, really, yeah. When you think about it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Who have we got today?
We have JR in Eastern Kentucky, and we have Matt in Perth, Western Australia, and we have Carl in Florida.
And then we have Matt in Perth, Western Australia again.
Yes, I just only said him once.
I know, and I just only said him twice.
Okay.
Okay, I didn't mean to cut you off. What were you going to say?
I don't know.
Because it was only one person, you didn't want to say his name twice? Okay, that makes sense.
It's the same person. We just heard from him twice.
Separate submissions, yes.
Yes.
Okay. So let's begin.
Okay. Oh, sorry. That was not a very auspicious beginning. It will be better, though. Okay, JR in Eastern Kentucky. Here are my results so far from using the citric acid and baking soda method of producing CO2. I started at the beginning of February with the goal of achieving 14 days of production at approximately 2.0 bubbles per second. I want to giggle every time I say bubbles per second. Bubbles! I don't know, it makes me think of like My Little Ponies.
I know, you mentioned that before. I'm not sure what the connection is.
But I don't know. It just looks like My Little Pony's like blowing bubbles and they're like calculating how many bubbles per second they can get out of their bubble blowing machine. I don't know. Okay. The little girl in me will try to subside. I started at the beginning of February with the goal of achieving 14 days of production at approximately 2.0 bubbles per second before I needed to replace the powder mixes. I first installed a ball valve and then a solenoid in order to run the CO2 only during the daylight hours for 8 hours a day. So far, the best I've been able to achieve is 9 days. So for me, the question I have to answer is this good enough to continue and is it worth the effort as opposed to switching to a pressurized system? To me, cost and maintenance are the only issues. When used on a small tank where you do not need more than 3 bubbles per second, my experience has been that the system is every bit as reliable and adjustable as a pressurized system. The citric acid in baking soda can produce far more than 3 bubbles per second, but I would think at that rate of production, powder consumption would make the system much less cost-effective. I asked users of pressure systems to share on average how much they spend on refilling their CO2 tanks per year. Based on those responses and my own personal experience in the past, it would seem that on average, users are refilling a CO2 tank twice a year. Costs and tank size varies, so I rounded out the results and we'll call it $30 a year for CO2 gas. Equipment costs for a regular setup can vary widely from $80 to $500 or more. I am going to use $200 as the cost of a regulator and tank for my cost calculations. I understand these costs will vary depending on your preference. So, pressurized system, $200. Citric acid with ball valve or solenoid, $45. Using these numbers, it costs $155 more for the pressure system at startup. How long will it take to make up that cost, comparing the price of the gas to citric acid and baking soda? By buying citric acid and baking soda at 50 pounds at a time on Amazon, a powder charge will cost me $1.50 every 9 days. That comes out to $60 a year and approximately $30 a year more expensive than CO2 gas for the pressure system. So at $30 a year, it would take 5 years to break even. After those 5 years, you will then save that $30 a year with the pressure system. I guess you have to ask how long did the pressure systems last? Are they still going to be functioning after 5 years?
That's,
I don't know. I have no idea.
About.
For me, at this time, I'm going to stay with the citric acid system simply because I do not wish to spend the money on a pressure system. Of course, I say that today. Who knows what tomorrow will bring? I hope this rambling makes sense. I am not now, nor have I ever been a writer, but I tried my best. I would be glad to answer questions and will continue to post updates as I play around with the powder formula to see if I can increase recharge times.
Hmm. That's a lot of good food for thought.
Mm-hmm.
And some very good information. I'm glad he put together the estimates.
Yeah, that's there. Nice. We can get that's an idea really good. That. So you can kind of get an idea.
Yeah.
Depending, of course, on what, you know, how expensive your system is when you start up, as there is a pretty big range. And
Right. There's...
How many bubbles per second you want?
Well, do you remember when we had our CO2 system set up and you'd hear the little... in the filter? Remember that? Uh-huh. See, that's how you could count bubbles per second. You could calculate it with a stopwatch.
Well, how many... It didn't do one of those every second.
No, it was more like one bubble every 3 seconds. Or 2 seconds, or whatever. Depending.
It was less frequent.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But at the same time, we didn't spend the money on a...
No, it was just a do-it-yourself yeast reactor, which is super cheap to set up and is not necessarily quite as cheap to maintain because of the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
I should do the calculations on how long it took to do sugar because...
Do you remember how long you every... Did you...
It was four cups of sugar.
It
was about
2 weeks or...
It was four cups of sugar a month.
4 cups of sugar a month.
Essentially.
It's not, sugar's not very expensive.
It's not. 4 cups of sugar a month because I did 2 cups per bottle. And I'd usually do 2 2-liter bottles per tank.
And you'd kind of switch one out every week. So it would go for 2 weeks, but you had them on a rotating... Something like that.
I rotated... I would do one bottle every 2 weeks.
Okay, so they lasted a month?
Yeah.
Okay.
Approximately, because it was the Nyberg yeast recipe, so that lasted longer than some...
Because it had plain protein sugar in it.
Yeah. And molasses and stuff like that. So
okay.
I would just replace... I found if I replaced one bottle every 2 weeks, I got pretty steady release all the way through. Because one of the bottles was always close to peak production, the other one was always, you know, coming down, and so it just... It balanced out nicely for me. And... I never got anything like, whoa, closet collapse.
Sorry, stuff falling out of the closet.
I never got 3 bubbles per second, of course, but I did get enough so that it made it.
We weren't trying to get that much,
no,
though.
No, it was to improve plant growth, and it measurably did so. Yeah, it was easy to see that it did so, so that was enough. But anyway, it is interesting to hear about this. Every time I hear anybody, any of our contributors talk about it or write about it, I want to... To try it every time. It would
be
really
fun. Someday
you'll
get to try it.
Someday I'll try it, Okay.
Okay, should we go to Matt's first...
Submission.
Yep. Communication.
Contribution.
Communique.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Okay. Says, G'day, Kelly and Russ. The species of catfish I had was Pterygolichthys.
That's quite a mouthful, isn't it?
Yes, I'm sure I didn't say it right either. Multiradiatus.
Okay.
A synonym for the species is Placostomus pardalis, or we just shorten it to placo. I always get a placo.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of placo is a pardalis?
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know. There's like 5 million kinds of placo, aren't there?
Precisely, yes. It is.
Okay.
It's... I am not particularly familiar with that exact species.
Okay.
I don't...
He says, the species can reach up to 50 centimeters or over 19 inches in length. Okay, so it's a big one. I had the placo for many years, so I don't think it was a time issue. The Oscars ate plenty of food, as do the silver sharks and clown loaches. I think tank size does have an effect on the growth of fish.
Hmm, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
A fish that can grow to 19 inches and never did. And I think this is, we're looking at in Matt's tank here, several, you know, exceptions to the general rule.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting to see those. And we have to take, you know, that data into account.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, well, even though we know that there are many, many, many cases where putting a fish in a tank that's too small, the fish will still outgrow the tank, it appears that there are some cases where it will not. And it's difficult to...
Seems like it would still be generally a good idea to be prepared for the fish to get big.
Oh, I agree.
Give it room.
I definitely agree, and I'm sure Matt would agree, too. Mm-hmm. But it is good for him to point out these situations where it doesn't hold true 100% of the time. And it would be very interesting if we could find out why. But the idea that it's the species that we mentioned in the last show about the Placostomus, wondering if it was just a species that stayed small, he's telling us it's not one of those situations. So it's interesting data. We always have to take into account data that doesn't fit with the general scheme of things and then see how that's going to change things in the future and so on. So it would be interesting to collect situations like this and see where we can find times where fish haven't, you know, additional cases.
See if there was some kind of similar factor among
the
cases
where they didn't. What factors are governing this? Because it's obviously there's something going on that we need to know more about. And like I said, there are many, many cases where just follow the normal rule where the fish just keep growing and, you know, will outgrow their tanks. But there are some cases where that doesn't happen, and we just need to find out more about it.
Okay, let's see. Here we go. I've attached two photos of my discus tank to this email. The darker photograph is the most recent one. My plants are definitely growing. However, it is not clear what is causing that. It could just be the light, the CO2 unit, the fish feces in the gravel, the plants fertilizing I'm dosing the tank with, the plant fertilizer I'm dosing the tank with, or a combination of them all. All with zero algae on the glass. It is a perfect aquarium.
Okay, we just took a pause to show Kelly the pictures because she hadn't seen them yet. And it really does look nice.
Yeah, you can definitely tell that the plants are growing.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Yeah. It looks really nice.
And like you're
clear and pretty.
It does. Yeah. And like he's saying, there are a lot of things that are going to be contributing to the plant growth. But it looks like CO2 is probably helping. I mean, that's the kind of growth that I have noticed. You know, it's pretty dramatic with some of the plants in there.
You know what? Somebody needs to come up with a product like that for hair.
That makes it grow like 10 inches a week?
Yes! Okay. It makes it all bright and shiny and healthy and grow really fast. I tell ya. Somebody invent that. Just that doesn't smell like a CO2 unit.
Well, I mean like a yeast reactor, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But it really does look nice, and you can tell that the plant growth we're comparing, look at this plant, look at this plant. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can definitely tell. So let's move on there to the next paragraph.
He says, so one big problem with my previous mentioned goal of moving the 6-foot tank into the middle of the room is I want to be able to see through from the back. To do that, I need to remove the foam fake rock from the tank. How exactly do you think is the best way to do that? Can I use the opportunity to have a sump hole cut in the tank, or do you think that it's too dangerous with an aged old girl like I have?
So is the foam fake rock up against the
back, right?
The back of the tank. I mean, I'm not explaining myself very clearly. What I mean is, now this is the 4-foot tank though, right?
Oh, and this isn't the one that he's moving.
Yeah, this is the 4-foot tank.
I don't know if we have a picture of the 6-foot tank.
The 6-foot tank is the other one. But the foam fake back, is it just, it's not cemented in any way with silicone or anything like that? Is it just pressure fitted in there?
Are you saying how exactly do you think is the best way to do that? So it's apparently attached in some way, otherwise you could just pull it out. So
well, maybe not, though. I don't know if it's... I'm asking more about that. I want to know more about that. Because it might depend on how it's attached in there. Also, with a bit about the sump hole cut in the tank, which, you know, that's often a very good idea in terms of filtration options that it offers and so on.
How old is the tank?
Yeah, how old is the tank? And I don't know much about it, really, if getting the tanks drilled, if an older tank is going to be... I mean, it makes sense that it would tend to be more fragile because older tanks are more fragile in general. But as far as drilling, if that's going to make a big difference or not, is a great question. I mean, you're going to have somebody come in and drill it, or you could drill it yourself.
Somebody who's like a glass company, I would suppose.
Well, a lot of aquarium people will get tanks. You know, people who build custom tanks will drill a tank for you.
Okay.
They have diamond drills and all this stuff that they're ready to do it with. But I don't know. I've never done it, so I don't know. That's a good question. I would probably call up a couple of places.
I hate to give you the wrong answer and have your tank explode.
Right, so I would just say you probably have to call up somebody, a company that does it, and tell them what your situation is and see what they say. Sometimes a tank will, you know, they'll drill it for you and they'll guarantee the tank. But then if you have them drill your own tank, I believe, if I recall correctly, then they won't necessarily do like that. But maybe if you find out something from a company, or if any of you out there have had one of your, you know, long-standing existing tanks drilled, if you've done it yourself, if you had someone do it, it'd be nice to hear about that and what your experiences were and whether or not you would recommend that Matt go ahead and do that. So that's, something for you Aquarimaxers to help us out with. And thank you, Matt.
Mm-hmm. It's time for that station break thingy when I tell you how you can play an active part in the Aquarimax community. If you want your questions or comments featured on the show, send us an email at info@aquarimax.com. Or call and leave a message at 801-477-0629. You can also subscribe to the Aquarimax YouTube channel, like our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter.
And now for a blatant but extremely brief plug.
Our ebook, The Aquarimax Guide to 7 Easy Live Foods, is available on Amazon.com for $2.99. Okay, so we have Carl from Florida. Was Carl last week and we didn't know where he was from yet?
Yes.
Is it the same Carl?
Yes.
And remind us what we had talked about.
Well, we're talking about his, about CO2. He is doing the same thing JR is doing with the
citric acid in the baking soda.
He heard about JR doing it and he decided to try it.
Okay.
So, yep.
Because he says, yes, you received the 30-second EMT trip report version. Last week it was short.
Yeah, it was short, and he didn't tell us who he was exactly. He said Carl, right. But he didn't say where he was from.
He says, yes, Phoenix is the light brand. I have one planted and plus over the 20-gallon high tank. I'm not sure what he means. Sorry.
Oh, planted plus. I'm not sure exactly either. Okay.
First time I have used the coral rocks in Aquascape. I thought they looked cool, and I had them. I read that cherry shrimp need the calcium, but now I have a really great outbreak of brown algae that is persisting. How bad did I screw up? CO2 and light, 6.30 hours a day, no ambient light. I work night shift, so windows are triple covered. 5 milliliters of fertilizers daily from the dry bulk supply place everyone always recommends. Do you know what that is? Is it a reference to a brand name?
Well, I can't remember what it is. I've read about it, but I don't remember what it is.
50% water changes every 10 days. No inhabitants yet.
And then he adds another paragraph later in a separate
email about the same thing. Clarify. He says, did I screw up by using coral instead of stone? He says, and after more...
Google foo.
That's probably not what he meant.
Yes, it is. Like kung fu. Google foo.
Oh, okay. Googled. Google foo. Okay. Yeah. After more Google foo, I believe you need to break down and purchase an RO filter. It is my understanding this will give me a solid base to start from and avoid the stress of fighting unknown variables from the tap. Is this correct?
Okay. Well, let's talk about that for a little while. One thing is that an RO unit will certainly help reduce unknown variables in your water because you know exactly what you're going to be adding thereafter in terms of nutrients, macro and micro. And so it can be safer in a lot of ways, and that's one of the reasons why in marine tanks and reef tanks, it's highly recommended to use RODI water or RO water to just take all the variables out. So once you add the salt mix, you have exactly what you desire and exactly what you expect in your water. So you can control nutrients and keep algae outbreaks to a minimum. So that is, it's the same idea in freshwater that if you start out with RO, that you can do the same thing. It's a lot easier to add what you want than it is to take out what's there in general. But if you're doing RO water, then that's what you get. You get to do that. So it will help, I think, in that sense. A couple of things, though. One is, I have not used coral rock in a freshwater. I've used them in brackish water. I've used them in saltwater. I haven't used coral rock in freshwater tanks, though. So I haven't dealt with this particular problem. If that is indeed the problem, that it's the coral that's causing it, it may or may not be that. But here's the thing that I would like to say about it. Cherry shrimp do need calcium, but if you already have moderately hard water, they're going to get enough calcium from water changes, in my experience. And we have pretty hard water
here. If you're not using the RO water.
Right. And we have pretty hard water. And when I've had cherry shrimp, and I have a number of years of experience with cherry shrimp, I've just, you know, done water changes with our pretty hard water, and it works fine. They do great with that. There's no need for additional calcium. Another thing, though, is that they... this tank, I'm not sure how long it's been set up, and you say it's planted. Now, if the tank is really planted, like heavily planted, you don't really need to cycle it. Because what's happening here, before you put the shrimp in, you don't need to. Because if you've got all the plants in there, and they're doing well, once they're, you know, they've settled in for a week or two, you can go ahead and put the shrimp in because they're going to be using up all the ammonia before it needs to be dealt with by bacteria. The plants are going to use them as nutrients, going to use that ammonium as nutrient, and there won't be a need for the nitrifying bacteria to deal with it. And the shrimp will be perfectly happy because, as far as they're concerned, the quantities of ammonia that build up in the water, well, they aren't going to build up because they're going to be metabolized by the plants. As long as the plants are healthy, they're abundant in the tank, you don't overcrowd it with, like, don't throw, you know, 700 shrimp in there, but this is a 20-gallon high tank. If you have 20 or 30 shrimp and you put them in there, they'll be fine as long as the plants are healthy and, you know, growing. And they will also eat lots of different types of algae. There are lots of things that could be called brown algae, so I'm not sure which type you have, but they will scrape off a lot of things like that. And so if you were to put them in, you might find that they deal with your algae problem perfectly well. And you won't need to worry about it. I mean, I'm not saying I can guarantee that because there are a lot of variables here, but I've had tanks where, you know, I set it up and I start getting an algae issue and I throw some cherry shrimp in there and pretty soon I don't have one anymore. The algae problem's gone. And the more shrimp you get, the better that is, and they will keep plants sparkling clean. If that's all you have in there is a bunch of cherry shrimp and you let them breed and there you've got, you know, dozens and dozens of cherry shrimp in your 20-gallon high tank, generally you'll find you don't have a speck of algae anywhere.
Kind of nice. Just eat it?
You feed them pretty sparingly anyway, the shrimp. Mm-hmm. They don't need tons of food. And they will just be industriously scraping off every surface all the time. There are certain types of algae in certain situations that they won't go for as much. But in general, that's what they do. If you've got the nice, healthy growing plants and you've got the shrimp, the plants will take care of any excess nutrients that algae would otherwise get. And any algae that does manage to grow under that environment, the shrimp will take care of, pretty much. I've had problems with, staghorn algae occasionally in shrimp tanks, minor problems with that. But I find out if I just have to tweak the nutrients a little bit and then it goes away. I don't have it anymore. So I kind of wonder a little bit about the just 6.3 hours a day. Personally, I might use a little bit more, but you know, there are different things you can do. You can experiment with the photo period a little bit. You could introduce a siesta period if you have a good timer where you have it run for 3 or 4 hours and then take an hour break and then run 3 or 4 hours again to get closer to 8 hours, you know. Mm-hmm. And things like that. Experimenting with the photo period sometimes that way with a siesta period can sometimes control algae because they're not so good at handling that siesta period, but higher plants are. But honestly, maybe you should try just throwing some of the shrimp in. No, not throwing them in literally, but
Adding them.
And seeing if that helps. But the RO water certainly couldn't help as long as you're making sure that you're getting the nutrients back in that need to be there. Couldn't hurt.
Okay.
If you make sure you're getting, you know, the proper nutrients back in. So there you go. Hopefully that helps.
Okay. And then we have the other email from Matt.
Yes.
And he has started on the marine tank path.
I could do a Yoda quote right
do
now.
I was waiting for you. Do a Yoda quote.
No, that's okay. I can't think
forever
of a good one right now.
Forever will it haunt your destiny.
Forever will it dominate your destiny.
There we go. Okay.
That wasn't a very good Yoda quote. I should have done a better one. That's okay. I'll practice.
Okay, think of one for the end.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
He says, my marine tank adventure has begun. I feel like the theme from 2001 A Space Odyssey should be playing. Here we go. I went down to my local beach and brought home some seawater. That sounds familiar.
Yeah, we used to do that in Hawaii all the time.
Yep. Says, you know what I've discovered from that experience? Water is really heavy. Yeah, it really is. Especially if you were lugging up from the beach in 20 liter, or that's 5.2 gallons, buckets.
And if you got a bucket on each hand, that's 10.4 gallons.
And a gallon of water is about
8.5 pounds
mm-hmm. per gallon.
Yep, that's a lot of pounds.
That's
a lot of heavy.
You don't have to go exercise now, Matt. You've got your weight training right there.
Yep.
I went to my local fish shop and brought home a 10-kilogram or 22-pound bag of coral sand. The sand apparently actually comes from coral islands and is processed to remove any impurities. It will keep the tank at a pH of around 8, which is good for marine tanks. Unfortunately, the local fish shop did not have much nice-looking live rock, so for now I just have an empty tank full of seawater and a bed of coral sand. I put an air stone and a heater in the tank so that when I do get some live rock, the water will be ready at the correct temperature and nicely aerated. I should have the live rock by the end of the week when the fish shop acquires new stock. Once the tank is full of live rock and has gone through its ammonia cycle of 4 to 6 weeks post-live rock, I shall start introducing fish. These are my planned fish inhabitants. 2 Ocellaris.
Mm-hmm.
Ocellaris.
Or Ocellaris. People say different things.
Clownfish. 1 6-line wrasse. 2 blue-green chromis. And 1 mandarin fish. I love mandarin fish! Okay, I have to tell you the first time I saw a mandarin fish. This was way back in the day, and Russ and I were still just dating. Were we engaged yet?
I don't actually recall. I do remember the event.
I don't think we were. I think it was...
We were going to that Japanese restaurant on Center Street, right?
We were going to a Japanese restaurant, and they had a fish tank, kind of like you want to do with your one in the middle of the room, where it's like a room divider.
Room divider, yeah.
So they have like the lobby where you're waiting for your table on one side of the fish tank and then the rest of the restaurant with all the tables on the other side of the fish tank. And I see this fish on the bottom and I just think, what is that? It's like psychedelic.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a hippie fish. I said, what is that fish?
And I told her it was sometimes called a psychedelic fish.
Because I said psychedelic looking. It's yeah. All these swirls. It's almost paisley. I don't know. It's yeah. Like...
And sometimes they are
Scooby-Doo,
called psychedelic
you
fish.
Know.
Yeah, I wasn't joking.
Yeah.
Although mandarin fish is more common in the hobby,
mm-hmm.
psychedelic fish has been used.
So every time I see one of those, I just go, oh, it's that weird funky fish! They're pretty neat.
And their scientific name is a funny name. I mean, something like this splendid fish whose feet and hands are in sync.
Okay. But that's cool that you're going to get a mandarin fish. They're very distinctive.
They are. Quite attractive fish.
He says, I will also put some of the hardier coral in that does not need a protein skimmer once the tank is really established. The clownfish will go first, followed by the blue-green chromies, mandarin fish, and 6-line wrasse. Or sorry, I missed the comma.
That's okay.
Followed by the blue-green chromies, mandarin fish, and 6-line wrasse. There we go. As the wrasse is semi-aggressive, it will go in last when everyone else is all settled into the tank. So, on to my questions. In my research into Red Sea aquariums, they do not have any aeration stones in these high-end setups, so do I need to aerate the water, particularly as I do not have a filter or protein skimmer planned for the time being?
Okay, well, one thing is that, as I understand it, salt water doesn't hold as much oxygen as fresh water. There's not as much of it that it can dissolve, and so you have to be pretty careful to make sure it does have enough oxygen in it. And we tend to keep, you know, less biomass of fish in the tank. Because of that.
In the salt water.
Of course, when we're in a... We're talking about a reef tank with a lot of photosynthetic organisms, that kind of changes things a little bit because, you know, you get oxygen added back to the water by the photosynthesis. But these tanks do... It looks like they do all have power heads running in them. And in fact, I did look at the link that you provided, and it looks like most of these setups come with an integrated filtration system and protein skimmer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, aeration stones per se are not particularly important because as long as you have things like power heads running.
Just to move the water.
Yeah, there's a lot of water movement going on when you have power heads. You don't need an air stone. I honestly don't recall if we've ever had a salt water tank with air stones per se. We may have early on, but most of them have been in filter systems, either the impeller-type filter system or a power head or both running. In general, in a reef tank situation or in a marine tank situation, water movement is highly emphasized, and in fact, much more so than in a freshwater tank, typically higher. They've got all kinds of power heads going, You really want that circulation to be stronger. And a lot of times, you know, people hook it up in with a wave machine or something so that you'll vary the current. Or what we did with our saltwater tank, or I guess it was a reef tank because it had corals in it and, you know, photosynthetic corals, and we had the right lighting for it and stuff. We had a power head that was hooked up to a rotating, there was a device that you attached to it. It's made by the company. It's called Hydor, but I don't remember what the device was called. But you hooked it up to a power head, and the force of the water caused the rotation. There were like a series of gears inside it, and it caused the rotation of this head, and the water would go in different directions. And so it kind of made a wave action through the tank where the current would vary in different directions. That's good for aeration because, you know, essentially you're increasing the surface area of the water in the tank by causing it to circulate up to the surface a lot more quickly than it otherwise would do. But it also helps prevent detritus from building up on photosynthetic organisms or building up in corners and creating dead spots where things can go stagnant or anoxic and things like that. So definitely you need a lot of movement in a marine tank. A lot of water movement is generally a good thing. There are very few exceptions to that. For example, with dwarf seahorses, you don't want near as much as you would with a lot of other setups. But in general, yes, you want a lot of water movement. And one of my questions is, in all these setups that I looked at on the Red Sea website, all of the tanks that I looked at, and I didn't look at all of them, but the ones that I looked at all had integrated powerheads and protein skimmers, I think. And a lot of them at least had filtration too. So, and I think that's a good thing. I think they should be there, and I think it's nice to take advantage of them if they're there. So what I'm asking, I guess, is how does that differ from your plan for what you're going to do? Are you going to take out the existing protein skimmer, or are you looking at a model that doesn't have one, or how that works? But yeah, in terms of air stones themselves, I don't think they're that important. But aeration, definitely, in terms of water circulation, is very important in marine tanks.
So as long as there's something doing that job.
And it has to be doing a pretty good job. I mean, you can't just have, like, one little thing in the corner that's, you know, doing a little circulating. A lot of times, if you see a reef tank, they've got power heads all over the place. They really want to get that water going. And a lot of the, you know, the fish that you keep in a reef are used to the surging of the waves.
Right.
And so they can handle a lot of current and are used to it, and it's better for them. And it's better for a lot of the corals, too.
You need that
ebb and flow of the water is a beneficial thing. It's what they've evolved to live in. So there you go.
Okay. He asks also, do you have any other advice regarding my burgeoning marine tank?
Well, let's see. First of all, we're excited for you. It's fun that it's happening. And clownfish, let's see. When you're getting clownfish, I mean, of course, we've only had one, and we had ours for a number of years, and the only reason we didn't have it after that was not because it passed away, but because we had to give it back to the pet store, because the tank crashed after one of our children put lots of goldfish food in it.
I was out of town. And I didn't notice.
We recovered what we could, but it wasn't much. But we were able to save our clownfish, but unfortunately not the tank. Anyway, the clownfish, if you get two young ones that are about the same size, you should probably be okay. Or if you get a known pair, where one is larger than the other, the larger one being the female, the smaller one being the male, since clownfish are interesting in that their sex determination is based on their social status, essentially, and on what they encounter first. So when the little tiny fish, when their larvae floating up in the water column, they descend down on the reef to find a place to live, they find a place where other clownfish are, usually. In the wild, it's very rare to find a host that doesn't have a clownfish. And so they'll find a group of clownfish and join it. And they will join it as a small individual, and they will stay small. And there will be a large female, and there will be a somewhat smaller male, and then there will be one or more juveniles. When that initial female, if it gets killed or if it dies or whatever, then the male that was just under it in the social status of the little group will grow and become a female, and then the next one up will become the male.
Interesting.
So if you put two in, it's likely that one of them will eventually become the male. There might be some squabbling, a male, and one will become the female, and there might be some squabbling in the meantime. But with 20 gallons, you should be safe. But if you already have a pair that's already bonded to each other, you should be safe too. But you wouldn't want to put in like two large adults from, you know, different tanks or something, because they'd be both females and you'd probably have a lot of fighting. But I don't think you were going to do that anyway. But something, aggression has sometimes been an issue with clownfish, I've heard, in situations like that. So just, you know, be aware of that and be careful. But as long as you're starting out with that in mind, it should help. Let's see. And hopefully you can listen to that podcast that Tony suggested, because they're far more expert about clownfish than I am and probably have some better advice for you. As far as hosting, you mentioned you wanted to get some soft corals. There are some soft corals that clownfish will try to host on that won't necessarily tolerate the hosting very well. So I would think about looking into types of corals that they can host on. Not that they will necessarily choose one of the soft corals you put in to host on, but they might, and it might not do the soft coral a whole lot of good. If it can sometimes stress out a soft coral to be a host of a couple of clownfish, depending on the species. So maybe look into, I think the toadstool leather mushroom coral is a good one to use. I think if you have a nice large rock covered in, is it star polyps, I think, they can do pretty well with that. There are some other things too, but just keep in mind that they're going to pick a place to host and it may not be ideal. And if it's a small coral that's not particularly appreciative of the constant tactile stimulation, it might not be the greatest thing ever for the poor little coral. So just something to, you know, look into. And then it's good that you're putting the six-line wrasse in last. That's a well-known best practice in marine aquariums to keep more aggressive species from being big problems, because the other fish already have an established territory. They know where the bolt holes are and they feel comfortable, and so they're more likely to be able to defend themselves. I don't know a lot about six-line wrasses specifically, but that general principle, I can see that you're applying that, and that's good. Now, the mandarin fish, that's a big mm-hmm. thing. They are really cool, and I'm sure you already know that they're a little bit tricky to feed, and the wild ones need lots of pods.
What kind of pods?
Pods? Copepods.
Racing pods?
Isopods. Amphipods. Not racing pods. Oh. Copepods, isopods, and amphipods are the three big pods.
Okay.
That you find in marine aquariums. But the thing is, mandarin fish really need stuff like that, and they're not very competitive eaters. Kind of like African dwarf frogs in a community freshwater tank don't do great usually unless you find provision for feeding them in a way that allows them to get the food and before everybody else does. It's true that captive bred mandarin fish are often easier to feed and they're more likely to accept, say, dry food, pellets, and things like that. But they're typically more expensive and harder to find than the wild caught ones. If you do have a wild mandarin fish, that's what you're getting, you might want to consider a refugium to grow lots of pods in that will populate the tank. Or a pod pile.
What's a pod pile?
This is the part where you ask what a pod pile is.
I just did. I know. I said, that's what's pretty a cool. pod pile?
I know. It's pretty cool. A pod pile is where you make an area of live rock. You pile it together in such a way that it's hard for fish to get down into the inside of it. It's kind of like a fortification of,
it's a well.
Of an area of live rock.
It's a well for pods.
In a way it is.
Pod well.
They're like a pod of whales? No, that's different.
That's okay. Different.
Lots of different kinds of pods, huh? So it's this, basically you have this fortified area where there's lots of surface area of live rock and so on, where they can hang out and you can put food down in there for them to eat, but the fish can't get in there. And then that ends up being a source area in the ecosystem where it's producing a lot of pods that then diffuse out into the rest of the tank. That's a sink area because other fish are eating them. So that's a pod pile. A refugium is very much...
How does it help the mandarin fish?
Because it eats the pods.
If all the other fish eat them too.
Well, the idea is that if you have a nice pod pile and it's producing lots of pods, then the mandarin fish is going to get a lot more to eat than it would otherwise.
Just because there's enough
higher density of pods in the tank.
Okay.
That's the idea. And that's the same idea with the refugium. It's just like a separate tank, for those of you who may not be familiar with the term. A separate tank, usually smaller, that's attached to your main tank. And the water therein flows into your main tank and then is pumped back out of your main tank into the refugium. But the idea is what's flowing out of the refugium doesn't go through like an impeller or something that'll chop little teeny crustacean bodies up into mush, but will just kind of overflow out of that tank and into your main tank, not causing any damage to little pods. And because the refugium doesn't have any predators in it to speak of, it's got algae and it's got live rock and it's got sometimes miracle mud or different things like that. At any rate, it's got a big area where lots of pods can grow, and then they flow out in the main tank. So it's very similar to a pod pile. It's just a separate tank attached to your main tank. And it can also serve other purposes. But refugium, the name comes from the idea is it's a refuge. It's a place where species can grow and be uninhibited in their growth because they're protected from predation.
Okay.
So something like that could be helped. You could also consider culturing pods separately and adding them periodically to your tank, but that's more work. I read something somewhere, and I wish I knew where, about somebody who taught a mandarin fish to eat pellets out of a jar. They put a glass jar on its side with pellets in it and would put it up next to the mandarin fish, and it would go into the jar and eat them, and the other fish, you know, didn't get in there as quickly or whatever, and so it did well. But I don't remember where I read that. Anyway, that's something to keep in mind, the unique needs of mandarin fish in terms of feeding. I believe that's all we have for this week, though.
That was good.
Thank you to all our contributors. And any of you aquariumaxers out there who have more experience in a marine tank than I do, because I've only had about, what did we figure, 5 or 6 years of marine tank experience?
Probably.
Something like that. And so not nearly as much as some of you out there. So if you have additional things you'd like to add, please feel free. And if you want to respond to any of the other things that were brought up today, we always welcome that. And until next week,
may the fish
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. To leave comments or questions that could be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.